Brethren, in my school years, I had very little use for history. It did not seem to have any useful purpose. There seemed to be so many details to remember for a test. And then after the test, those details were promptly forgotten. And I don't consider myself today, even yet, a careful student of history. However, it was after I left school that I read the second, third, and fourth volumes of Studies in the Scriptures. And then history became very significant in proving the validity of the truth, in tracing the pattern of God's dealings and the directions and courses of His people, and the fulfillment of His word and His prophecies. The book of Daniel is full of these kind of milestones. Having run its full length, the book of Daniel stops with the 12th chapter. And this 12th chapter is full of inspiring clues, if they can only be understood. Daniel carries us up to the time when Michael would stand up and dispel the oppressive power, the abomination of desolation. And the question arises in chapter 12, verse 6. How long shall it be to the end of these wonders? And the answer comes in three parts. Verse 7, that there would be 1260 years till he shall have accomplished to scatter the power of the holy people. And verse 10, we are told that there would be 1290 days or years till many shall be purified and made white. And in verse 11, we find that there would be 1335 years till the blessed consummation of waiting should be reached. Now we want to consider this, that no prophecy of time is any stronger than its known beginning point. And such prophecies stand on the strength of their known clues, the internal evidence. To know where the days of Daniel begin is to know where the days of waiting end. And yet, in a fuller sense, no prophecy is any value unless it can have a meaning and a relationship to our days. And Daniel told us this would be a blessed expectation, the standing up of Michael. We're living in those days. How strong is our confidence in the beginning point of these prophecies? Now we know when Jesus returns from other prophetic lines of evidence. We have the Jubilees, we have the parallels, and we have the 6,000 years from creation. And by knowing, by virtue of the Jubilees, that he returned in 1874, we have a proper assumption that it was 2 years in the garden and that 6,000 years from the fall reaches to our Lord's return. We know that the prophecies that mark the event of papacy's rising to its position of desolating power, they occur in Daniel the 7th chapter, verse 8. We might turn to that. It says, I considered the horns, and behold, there came up among them another little horn, before whom there were three of the first horns plucked up by the roots. And behold, in this horn were eyes like the eyes of a man, and a mouth speaking great things. I think we are all familiar with the background of this vision, the beastly powers. And these horns were on the horns of the fourth beast, Rome. Down into verse 10 we read, "And a fiery stream issued and came forth from before him. Thousand thousands ministered unto him, and 10,000 times..." I have the wrong verse. That's not the verse I wanted to read. I wanted to read verse 20. "And the 10 horns that were in his head, and of the other which came up, and before whom 3 fell, even of that horn that had eyes, and a mouth that spake very great things, whose look was more stout than his fellows." And we wanted to read also verse 24 and 25. "And the 10 horns out of this kingdom are 10 kings that shall arise, and another shall arise after them, and he shall be diverse from the first, and he shall subdue 3 kings. And he shall speak great words against the Most High, and shall wear out the saints of the Most High, and think to change times and laws, and they shall be given into his hand until a time and times and the dividing of time." Brother Russell's explanation of this time frame is found in the third volume, page 68. And these are his words. We're just refreshing our memory here. He says, "Since the close of the times of papal power are not only thus clearly fixed as occurring during the French Revolution, but also by the events of chapter 11, that's Daniel 11, verse 40 to 44, which marked the very year 1799, we can readily measure backward 1260 years to note whether papal power had its beginning there. If we find that it had, we have our evidence as clear and strong as faith could ask. Let us verify. Measuring back 1260 years from 1799 would bring us to AD 539, where we shall show the papal power began." Our purpose this afternoon is to review some of the volume's description of account of this date. Secondly, to identify the 3 horns of Daniel and why they needed plucking up. Thirdly, to establish 539 from historical records. And fourthly, to reflect on the significance of that date. In this way, we hope to reconfirm our faith in the time prophecies, which are already strong, but sometimes we need reminding and clarification of the details to strengthen that faith. First, consider the handouts that you have. On the left side is the timeline running down the page. There are a few missing dates. We didn't list all the dates, and they're just marked with a dash. And then there is the Western and the Eastern empires on the left and the right. And running down the middle is the line of a few popes that we have given. Papacy's rise to power. We're going to explain these things a little bit more. But the Western Empire was Rome. The Eastern Empire was in Constantinople. Then under the Western Empire, there is numbered 1, 2, and 3 to help us identify the 3 horns and their rulers. You will notice some brackets on the Eastern Empire on some numbers, and also down here under the Ostrogothic Kingdom. They merely represent successive years of the reign of one of these kings, like the years of Justinian's reign, year 1, year 2, year 3. Or, in the case of beginning with Justinian's year 9, there's a number of dashes running over to number 1, 2, 3, and so forth. These are the successive years of the Gothic Wars. So this is just a count reference that we will be using.
Also,
then at the end of the page, you'll notice at the end of the papacy column, there's a little arrow that turns the corner, representing the time that the papal power came into control in the Western Empire. The date that the little horn had plucked up the last of the three little ones. And the 1260 years began. In a way, that's the theme of our whole lesson, so we could quit here, but we'll fill in a few more details. The setting for these times, the background for these times, is given by Brother Russell in a third volume, page 70. And he says this: "The spirit of rivalry was abroad, and other bishops in other large cities claimed supremacy also, some upon one and some upon another ground. It was not until A.D. 533 that the bishop of Rome was thus recognized by the emperor Justinian I. This was in connection with a warm religious discussion in which the emperor took sides with the bishop of Rome, recognizing the Virgin Mary's worthiness of adoration and disputing with the Eutychians and Nestorians regarding distinctions and blendings of nature in our Lord Jesus. The emperor feared that the discussion might divide the church and thus divide the empire, which he was desirous of more firmly uniting. For even at that early day, the nominal church and the empire were one and the same, Christendom. And desiring to have some authority as a standard to settle the dispute, and to tell the people what to believe and what to disbelieve, and finding the Bishop of Rome already the most popular of the claimants to primacy, popedom, or headship, as well as the most orthodox, the most nearly in harmony with the emperor's views of the question, Justinian by documents not only condemned the doctrines of the Eutychians and Nestorians, but addressing the Bishop of Rome as the head of the holy churches and of all the holy priests of God, thus acknowledged him and desired to assist the Pope in putting down the heresy and establishing the unity of the church." This is third volume background information describing the times of how the controversy in the church was attempted to be settled by Justinian and the supporting of the church in the West. After this discussion by Brother Russell follows a letter from Emperor Justinian to Pope John dated 533, where he maneuvers to exalt John's power and to unify the kingdom under his doctrine. Then Brother Russell quotes John's reply back to Justinian in 534. The mail services were not much more efficient than they are today. To show that he took the bait. He also quotes Justinian's letter to the Patriarch of Constantinople with instructions to cooperate. But this, Brother Russell says, was really only paperwork. For he says on page 76 of the third volume, "Justinian was far from Rome, with his capital at Constantinople. Roman Italy in general was under the sway of another kingdom, the Ostrogoths, who did not recognize the Bishop of Rome as supreme pontiff. For they were mainly Arians in faith. Papacy, therefore, was exalted and advanced in name only by the emperor's recognition until the fall of the Ostrogothic monarchy, when its exaltation became an actual fact. Indeed, as if by preconcerted arrangement, the emperor at once, A.D. 534, sent Belisarius and his army into Italy. And in 6 years after the pope's recognition by the emperor, the Ostrogothic power was vanquished and their king Vitiges and the flower of his army were taken with other trophies to Justinian's feet. This was A.D. 539, which is therefore the point of time from which we should reckon the desolating abomination set up. Papacy there had its small beginning. There the little peculiar horn noted in Daniel's prophecy just began to push itself up upon the Roman beast. The prophet had said that three horns would be plucked up or rooted out to make room or prepare the way for this peculiar power or horn. And so we find it. Constantine built Constantinople and removed his capital thither. This, though favorable to papacy's development in the seat of the Caesars, was unfavorable to the empire. And soon it was found expedient to divide the empire, and Italy was thenceforth known as the Western Empire, whose seat or capital was Ravenna. This was one of the horns. It fell in AD 476 at the hands of the Heruli, another of the horns which established itself on its ruins. Next came the Ostrogothic kingdom, another horn, overthrowing the Heruli and establishing itself as the ruler of Italy, AD 489. And as we have just seen, it was during the power of this horn, the third to be rooted out to make way for the papal horn, that Justinian acknowledged the papal supremacy. And it was by his orders and by his general and his army that it was plucked up. Indeed, it seems not improbable that papacy was secretly favorable to the fall of each of these horns or powers, hoping thus to open the way to its own exaltation, just as it finally resulted. Well, that's about all we'll read from the volumes to refresh our memory of what Brother Russell says. These volume excerpts form the basis of our query, who were these three horns? And Brother Russell helps us to identify them here. And why did they need removing for the growth of papacy? Let's go back to the time of Constantine and the beginning of the top of the handouts, the charts. The empire was sprawling and very hard to control. So Constantine devised in 330 to establish two capitals, one in Rome and the other in Constantinople, each with an emperor and a senate, with armies and courts. Each was to honor the ruling of the other's capital, and so broaden the base of control over an immense kingdom. The region of Constantinople was called the Eastern Empire, and Italy, with Rome, its head, the Western Empire. Constantine converted to Christianity and convened the Nicene Council in 325. It was there at that council that 318 bishops disputed over the nature of Jesus and the identity of God. Arius defended our faith in the humanity of Jesus as the Son of God. He was defeated in these debates and banished from the empire. However, in later years, sometimes his followers had more or less influence, and even influence in the empire. However, ultimately, it was the Trinitarians who finally prospered in the young Catholic Church. While it looked as if the Western Empire had been handed to the Roman bishop on a silver platter, it was not really so. The Western Empire was ruled by the Senate. It chose its emperor. The empire was besieged by German tribes, however. The Western culture was weakened by affluence, indulgence, political graft, and carelessness. The emperors were weak and often the subject of assassination. Not really a strong arm of the Roman Empire. Italy was so weakened as to be overrun by the Visigoths, that is, the West Goths, and their king Alaric in 410. And henceforth, Rome was always accommodating or conceding somehow to these German tribes. Most of these Gothic tribes were Arians in belief. That is, to them, Jehovah alone was the supreme Godhead.
Jesus had been created separately and did not share the divine nature while in the flesh, according to the faith of Arius. Now, this doesn't mean that they were all our brethren in the sense of Christians, but this is the general following that they had. They lended themselves to Arius's belief. Rome called them barbarians for their uncultured manner and customs. We think that this weak, conciliatory, and corrupt Western Empire was the first little horn needing to be uprooted, the Western Empire and its label number one, beginning at 330. The church, however, did not have the ruling hand at this time. The civil power, though accommodating the church, made and forbade laws. They turned to pagan gods to assist in desperate straits, not to the church. And so it was, in this vein of ebb and flow of power, until Romulus Augustulus, which is noted in 475 in the Western Empire, the last of the Roman emperors, the Roman beast was rooted out because it was rotted from within. It proved little resistance to the second horn, the Germanic Heruli, with their leader, Prince Odoacer, in 476. Whereas previous horns, of these ten horns, had succeeded one another in the Roman Empire, this one was removed. There was a natural succession before this plucking up. First, there was the Republic, ruled by the Caesars as monarchs. Then came a transition to the democratic form of government, ruled by the Senate. Then the transition to the Western Empire under Constantine. But this did not evolve as a natural succession into the next. It was plucked out. It was overthrown and overran. The year 476 has commonly been taken as the date of the fall of the Western Empire and the beginning of the Middle Ages. Even before this date, German tribes were enlisted in the service of the empire. They had become accustomed to set up and depose emperors to suit their own special interests. And finally, in 476, Odoacer, the most powerful of the rival German generals in Italy, banished the last of the Western emperors and ruled in his stead. Goodrich's Encyclopedia says, "The revolution of 476, which put an end to the Roman Empire in the West, forms one of the most strongly marked epochs in the history of the world." But that view, really, friends, is only in retrospect. That is not particularly how the people of the empire saw it at that time. The Heruli prince, Odoacer, had another problem. How was he going to calm the wrath of Zeno? And he's noted in the east. He was the emperor of the Eastern Empire that was supposed to keep the Western Empire under control. How was he going to calm his wrath and placate the Roman population in the west under his control? What he did was to send the imperial insignia to Zeno and declare his subordination to him, with the modest request to rule the Italian diocese under the title of patrician, while locally he reconvened the Senate and commanded respect of the imperial laws. So the population at that time noticed little outward difference, and except for two things. There was now a military might in the West, and the Heruli were Arians. While granting the Catholic Church liberty, they strictly limited its political influence. While strongly and formally acknowledging Constantinople and Zeno in the east, Odoacer actually ignored the Eastern Emperor, and his independence gradually grew stronger. While this was happening, the young Ostrogothic prince was being trained, another prince, not the Heruli, an Ostrogothic prince was being trained in the arts of war and government in Constantinople. And his name was Theodoric. In 475, the Ostrogoths proclaimed him as their king. Now, this was not yet a threat to the West, but the Ostrogoths took him as their king. Zeno was plagued with this independent Odoacer in the West. And he was getting more and more independent. What would he do? Zeno, seeing this menace in his own Eastern Empire, Ostrogothic Prince Theodoric, wanted to get him out of his East, and yet he wanted to handle the West. So he suggests to Odoacer, to Odoacer, to go west and invade the Western Empire. I think I'm getting tangled in my words, and if I'm getting tangled, surely you're getting tangled. Let me go back. He suggested to Theodoric, the Ostrogothic prince, to invade the Heruli Empire under Odoacer. Maybe that's the simplest we can state it. He suggested that got rid of the independent Theodoric in the east, and hopefully suppress Odoacer's independence in the west. And so he did. He entered Italy in 489. And that's why Brother Russell says that, uses this date on page 77 of the third volume, 489, is referenced there. At first, however, Theodoric struck a treaty with Odoacer for joint rulership of Italy. But it was not until 493 that Theodoric invited Odoacer and his sons to dine with him at Ravenna. There he fed them generously, and then he slew them both with his own hand after dinner for his sole rulership of Rome. He didn't want to share. And so the second horn had been plucked up. And the Ostrogoths now were the third horn, replacing the Heruli. Theodoric had been selected for this task by Zeno in the east because, though an Arian, he was more moderate than Odoacer, as well as schooled in allegiance to the Eastern Byzantium and guaranteed greater liberty to the Trinitarian Catholics. Though he appointed some Arian bishops, he still protected the Orthodox Church, its property, and its worship. One of Theodoric's ministers penned this memorable policy of religious freedom. "We cannot command religion, for no one can be forced to believe against his will." But of course, the man of sin, the papacy running down the middle between these two empires, the Antichrist, did not really want toleration for all. The man of sin wanted complete power and authority. We think that this time of struggle of the false church with civil Rome is the war in Revelation 12, 7 through 8. Antichrist had already assumed the name Michael. Indeed, the mystery of iniquity had already been conceived in Paul's day. We would suggest that it was brought forth in Constantine's day, Revelation 12:5. And that this war in heaven, verse 7, Revelation 12:7, we are inclined to think occurred in these years just before 539, before the woman, the true church, flees into the wilderness for 1260 years. This is a suggestion, and you might consider that sequence of events paralleling Revelation 12. We certainly would not be dogmatic on the point. This Ostrogothic horn continued till Theodoric died in 526. That's another date marked on the left side of the chart. He left the throne to his grandson, Athalaric, because he had no son. And so it was that his daughter, Amalasantha, and I may be crucifying that enunciation, but that seems how it's spelled phonetically to us, his daughter served as guardian to the throne till Athalaric would come of age. But this, her son, was very sickly, and after a few years, he died. And so she invited her cousin, Theodohad, to share the throne with her. And so he is shown on the chart in 534, Theodohad. But he didn't want to share the throne. And so what did he do? He had her killed. The year after Theodoric's death, one of the, this is going back a little bit, before Theodohad, at the time he appointed his grandson, Theodoric died in 526. The next year, 527, one of the greatest emperors in the East, Justinian, came to the throne at Constantinople. He undertook to regain the empire for the provinces of Africa and Italy. And his general Belisarius overcame the Vandal kingdom in North Africa in 534. And so it was amidst these unsettled situations that Justinian determined once and for all to uproot this Gothic horn, to reoccupy Italy, now with Roman soldiers, and align the military power behind the church as the head of the empire. It was the years 533 to 534 that the exchange of letters quoted in Volume 3 occurred between Justinian and Pope John. This was at the treacherous act of Theodohad against his cousin Amalasantha. Justinian saw that this kingdom was very unstable. And so this exchange of letters occurred. Upon learning of the independent Theodohad's usurpation of the western throne, he called on his general Belisarius, who in 534 was in Africa, to do the job for him. Belisarius entered Sicily immediately in 535, marking the first year of the Gothic Wars. Now, establishing the accuracy of 539 as the date of the subjugation of the Ostrogothic horn, and hence the setting up of the Antichrist, depends on knowing that 535 was the first year of these wars, and knowing the events of the next 5 years. Fortunately, there was a historian named Procopius, who was an advisor to Belisarius, and traveled with him on this Italian campaign called the Gothic Wars. He is very careful in noting the events of each year of the war. However, our AD dating had not come into common use yet. So he gives four time points to fix the first and second years of the war. And they are summarized on the bottom of the chart in brackets under Procopius' comments. He says, first of all, that the first year of the war was Justinian's ninth year of reign. Well, all history agrees that Justinian began his reign in 527, was his first year. His ninth year would correspond to 535, and you can just count them down as we have in brackets there. His second statement is that the second year of the war, when Belisarius captured Naples and Rome, he said, is said to be the third year of Theodohad in the West. Now, Theodohad is known to have come to the throne in 534. That was his first year. 535 was his second. 536 was his third year. Procopius says that this third year of Theodohad was the second year of the war, therefore 536. His third statement is that this event, the second year of the war and the capturing of Rome, is said to be 60 years after the Heruli victory of Odacer, known to be 476. And all history agrees with that date. So 476 plus 60 is 536, the second year of the war. Here, all three lines of evidence concur with other histories that fix the dates of Odacer, Justinian, and Theodohad. The reason we have Theodatus in brackets is that some histories spell his name that way, and if you're looking this up at some later time, it might be under one or the other spellings in 534. The testimony confirms 535 as the first year of the Gothic War and 536 as the second. There is a fourth statement by Procopius that cannot be harmonized with the other three statements, and we've marked it at the bottom of the page with a little question mark. He says, and we quote, "Rome became subject to the Romans again after 60 years on the ninth day of the last month, which is called December, by the Romans, in the 11th year of the reign of the Emperor Justinian." Well, the statements just do not agree. For 60 years after Odacer was the 10th year of Justinian. And you can see that on the chart, that 60 years after Odacer was 536. Odacer in 476 plus 60. That is not the 11th year of Justinian. The only explanation that I can come up is that either Procopius made an error or there is a transcript error in the Greek text. It is this error, however, that has caused some historians to date the war from 536 and 5 years later the fall of Ravenna in 540. In Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire footnotes, he notes this discrepancy and weights the evidence for the war beginning in 535, not 536, and we believe that he is correct. And yet, all historians took the fourth line of evidence, which is the only exception, and based their conclusions on it, apparently. Let's briefly cover the events and just kind of organize our thinking a bit. Just preceding the Gothic Wars, Justinian wished to reunify the Roman Empire. Ostrogothic powers held the throne. He wrote to Pope John II stating his intention to subjugate the Western Empire into the hands of papacy. Theodohad was invited to share the Gothic throne in 534 upon young Athalaric's death. But this sharing with Amalathansa did not last more than a year. Procopius says, Theodotus, upon receiving the supreme power, began to act in all things contrary to the hopes she had intended and to the promises he had made. During this second year, he slew her supporters, imprisoned and exiled her, and then she also was killed. And then Procopius continues, Justinian, upon learning what had befallen Amalasanta, immediately entered upon the war, being the ninth year of his reign. From here, Procopius carefully recounts the events of each year of the war to recover Italy for Justinian. He concludes each account with these words, and the winter drew to a close in the first or the second or the third year ended in this war, the history which Procopius has written. So, in summary, knowing the date 535 as the first year of the Gothic War, even if other dating methods are obscure, we can be sure what year it was that any event during the war happened, according to Procopius' account, especially the fall of the last Ostrogothic king, the third horn on the beast of Daniel's vision. In this first year, Theodo had appointed Agapetus pope, and he is noted in the pope's column. He was sent to Constantinople to try to deter Justinian in his western campaign, but it was to no avail, and he died after 11 months and 3 weeks of reign. In 536, the second year of the war, saw three significant events. Silvarius was appointed pope in the place of Agapetus by Theodohad in June. The Goths, recognizing Theodohad's weakness as a leader, threw him out in favor of Vitiges as a military leader. And this was Theodohad's third year of reign, and Vitiges' first year. Early in the year, Belisarius moves into Italy and captures Naples through an aqueduct. He laid siege against Rome on the 1st of March, but with delays in wages for his army and hungry soldiers, it was not till the 9th of December that they entered Rome, though for some months there were sectors of resistance. Rome was back in the hands of Roman soldiers. And thus ended the second year of the war. One of the first executive acts of Belisarius was to exile the Gothic loyal Pope Silvarius and install Vigilius as more to his liking. Though Silvarius appealed to Justinian, he died late in the third year of the war, 537. And these are also, you can draw a cross on the chart and find where these occurred. This year saw Vitiges' forces trying to retake Rome, but while Belisarius firmly held the city, his forces advanced on other Gothic-held cities. So Vitiges broke off the siege in order to regroup his forces in Ravenna, his capital, with Ariminum, a city just to the south of Ravenna, was under siege by the Roman army. In the next year, 538, Ariminum falls to the Romans and Vitiges vainly tries to recover it. As city after city fell to Belisarius and Vitiges saw the battle coming closer to the gates of Ravenna, he devised a clever scheme. Vitiges sent envoys or messengers with a letter to Chosroes, king of the Medes. Now, Media is not, the Persians are not noted on the chart. And he offered him, however, a huge sum of money and alliances if he would break a treaty that Persia had with Constantinople and besiege Justinian the East. It was a diversionary tactic. The whole scheme was intended as a distraction, knowing that Justinian would recall Belisarius and his forces in Italy to defend his own frontiers in Constantinople. Procopius says, among these suggestions, the idea also was advanced that the emperor of the Romans had plainly, plainly never been able to make war upon the barbarians in the West before the time when the treaty had been made with the Persians. For it was only then that the Vandals and Moors had been destroyed, and the Goths had suffered their present misfortunes. Consequently, if someone should once more rouse the hostility of the king of the Medes against the emperor Justinian, the Romans thereafter would never be able, once that nation had been stirred up to war against them, to carry on another war against any people in the world. End of the quote from Procopius. The plan was carried out, and it had its effect. Procopius says, when the emperor heard that Chosroes and the Persians were planning to this end, he decided to bring the war in the west to an end as quickly as possible and recall Belisarius in order that he might take the field against the Persians. So he sent word for Belisarius to draw up a treaty with the Goths in such a form that the interests of both sides would be furthered. This was as the winter of 538, the fourth year of the war, drew to a close. But God had his own timetable and would not allow this last little horn to fall a year too early or too late. Notice, brethren, had this order been obeyed promptly, the object of subduing the Western Empire under papacy would have been delayed for some years as a shared rule in the West. But Belisarius had fought far too long and hard to leave with a shared rule with a Gothic power still in control. So now, in the fifth year of the war, 539, the news reaches Belisarius of Justinian's order, and he first of all ignored it. From here on, there were a number of events that Belisarius regarded as providential and took as omens to continue his pursuit of the Goths. It demonstrates the principle in history that the mind that is bent on its own devices can see no further and reads all in favor of its own cause. And so was Belisarius' thinking. One of these events was that the Goths had assembled a fleet of ships on the river Po with food and supplies for Ravenna. However, the river dropped so drastically that the ships could not pass and were taken by Belisarius. The river not long afterwards returned to its proper volume and became navigable. As far as we know from tradition, this had never happened to the river before. And so Belisarius now set siege directly upon Ravenna. But the city was heavily defended. This was an advantageous time for another German tribe, the Franks. For a share in the rule of Italy, they offered to join forces with the Goths against the Romans. But about this time, envoys from Justinian arrived to offer the terms of peace to Vitiges in Ravenna for a joint rule of Rome. A decisive victory was about to be snatched from the hands of Belisarius, either by a third party or by his own emperor, Justinian. Vitiges favored a peace treaty with the Romans, but became very suspicious when Belisarius would not ratify it with his own signature. And his own Roman troops were complaining bitterly against Belisarius. They were weary of the war and wanted to break it off. They wanted to quit. And they were pressed hard with famine in their own midst. Belisarius perceived an advantage. He had to make a decision quickly. He let it appear that he had gladly received the proposal for peace and joint rule. And he let it appear so to Vitiges. And he received his envoys and pledged protection of them and of the Gothic forces and to general terms of a treaty. With these assurances, the Gothic envoys conducted Belisarius and his armies through the open gates of Ravenna without resistance. Belisarius had intentionally been vague. He quickly took Vitiges prisoner and subdued the palace guards. The palace treasure was seized, and whatever private property was to be had was in his hands. And soon all Gothic resistance in Italy crumbled. I'd like to read a very perceptive conclusion by Procopius. He writes, "While I watched the entry of the Roman army into Ravenna at that time, an idea came to me to the effect that it is not at all by the wisdom of men or by any other sort of excellence on their part that events are brought to fulfillment, but that there is some divine power which is ever warping their purposes and shifting them in such a way that there will be nothing to hinder that which is being brought to pass. And Belisarius took his way to Byzantium, and the winter drew to a close, and the fifth year ended in this war, the history which Procopius has written, and that was 539. And so the third horn was plucked up. As Belisarius returned with the spoils of war in 540, it was with the implicit understanding that the Pope in Rome was the chief authority and that the Roman army would be there to defend him. Though civil heads were subsequently appointed in the West, they were ultimately subject to the church head. It was a small beginning for the little horn, but in the years to follow it would grow and speak great words and subdue other nations. Why should such an obscure event in history mark the beginning of Daniel's vision of the three prophetic dates we mentioned at the beginning of the lesson? Constantine's conversion to Christianity in 312 would seem to some a more likely date. But brethren, he was not the church. He was a civil emperor who only strongly influenced the church and was influenced by it. Some others would consider Pepin's donation of the papal states in 756. Or the coronation of Charlemagne in 800 as more significant. But the papacy had already been commanding civil affairs before it owned lands and crowned kings. And so we see that it was here in 539 when the last of the three horns were plucked up to make way for the papal horn that the delicate balance of civil power was redefined to reside in the church and its head, the Pope. We have looked at only a little slice of history and prophecy. But what does all this mean to us? What significance has this ripple in history held for us today? Well, for one thing, we are instructed not to despise the day of small beginnings. Who would believe that the small political beginnings of papacy would spread to the deceiving of nations and to the wearing out of saints? Secondly, our faith is confirmed in the foreknowledge of God, his control over empires and dominions, in the sureness of his judgment that sets on the systems that were once permitted, now to take away the dominion, to consume and destroy it until the end. Daniel 7:26. Thirdly, the chronology given us through Pastor Russell is still as clear and fresh and true as when we first received it. And lastly, it is only as we see these prophecies that the signs of our times are coming to pass do we then understand that Michael has stood up and claimed the blessing of the 1,335 days. And we claim that with you, for Michael has indeed stood up. May the Lord add his blessing.
Thank you, Brother Jerry. I never realized that a little horn would have so much history attached to it. But apparently Jerry Leslie has been a good student in history, bringing us up to date and lining it up with Daniel's prophecy. Brother Jerry is going to leave for home, and I think all of us would like to send our love back to his class.